between us. This is Amy Elkhorn, science-based, nationally syndicated columnist and your host of a very exciting show tonight with social scientist Dr. Adam Galinsky on when to cooperate and when to compete. So hi, everyone, and yes, we've renamed the show, formerly Advice Goddess Radio, and now it better describes what we're actually doing here, which is talking with the luminaries of behavioral science about their research and their books and giving you applied science advice to improve your work life, your friendships, and your relationships. Now, as for tonight's show, there are all these books out there on how to succeed in life. Business books especially tend to come on like Mel Gibson and Braveheart. Now, I won't do the accent because I might hurt you if I do, but it's basically slay them all. So these books, they're all about winning by killing the competition. And then suddenly there came to be this sort of touchy-feely trend in business books. And I don't mean to knock all of these because some of them are very good. But my guest tonight, Dr. Adam Galinsky, takes a more nuanced approach. He explains that maximizing our potential for success sometimes takes cooperating and sometimes takes competing and sometimes takes doing a little of each. So on this show, he will explain the science behind his thinking and the research he's done and give you some very valuable tips on how you can succeed in your goals, whether they're social, romantic, or work goals. And you do that by knowing when to cooperate, when to compete, and the finer points of how to do each. So Galinsky's new book we'll be discussing, co-authored with Dr. Maurice Schweitzer, is Friend and Foe, When to Cooperate, When to Compete, and How to Succeed at Both. Hello, Adam.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very excited. You're our first guest on our new show, and I just loved your book. There's a great story right at the beginning about the Peruvian president, Fujimori, who had to deal with this 1996 attack on the Japanese embassy in Peru. And you say that he had a dilemma. And so putting it in cooperation or competition terms, he could either cooperate with the hostage takers and negotiate a solution, or he could compete with them, launch an attack on the compound. So tell us about what he did.
Well, you know, you look at this and you see these two different choices, cooperate or compete, as you said. And what he did is he did cooperate. He ended up working with a number of different embassies around the world, trying to come up with a negotiated agreement. But he was actually using that cooperation more as a ruse or a cover, because at the same time as he was dragging out these negotiations, he had a group of people who were secretly digging a tunnel that were going to lead to a little invasion to take over the hostages. And so right when the Canadian, ambassador who thought they were about to reach an agreement announced that, you know, to the press a few days later, when they were playing their soccer game, the rebels and the hostage takers were playing their daily soccer game, they invaded and ended up collecting almost all of the hostages and losing only one of their lives while killing many of the hostage takers. And so in this case, it was a ruse or a appearance of cooperation that was really designed to mask the competitive strategy that was going underneath the surface, literally.
And you explain that humans are wired to both cooperate and compete, and that there's the ongoing tension between them that emerges from this. You say there are three fundamental forces, and I'll just read them, that resources are scarce, that we're social beings, and that we live in an inherently unstable world. So explain how scarcity plays into the tension between cooperation and competition.
I mean, scarcity really tips the balance away from cooperation towards competition. We see this on Thanksgiving, right? So Thanksgiving is one of the most cooperative days that we have. In fact, its origins are based in trying to move people from competition to cooperation with the Native Americans and the settlers. But a few hours after our Thanksgiving dinner, we rush to Walmart or some of the stores where they have a number of scarce sales. So one of the most famous examples of this was a case in 2008 where a Walmart store had a couple TVs, I think, that were like 80% off, but there are only two of those TVs. And there were, you know, only two DVD players that were really cheap. And so what happened is that they ended up just such a large crowd, took the doors off the hinges, literally stampled over the employees, and even actually trampled a person to death, one of the Walmart employees. And so you can see how the scarcity, there's only two of these TVs, there's only, you know, one of these DVD players, inspires incredible fierce competition. And that's really one of those sources. Now, it's also true that these scarce resources are changing all the time, fundamentally changing. there, we talk about some zebras in Africa who form completely different social relationships depending on the scarcity of water. On any given season when water is plentiful, they form these cooperative collectives, but when water becomes scarce, they descend into sort of pairing off each other. And so you can really see these processes come into play.
Yeah, I think you bring up something important. This is something evolutionary psychology emphasizes, that our behavior is adaptive, and it's adaptive to the environment. So you discuss the environment with two TVs for, you know, a million stampeding people, and also for the zebras. And I think that that's a really important thing to remember. But also you talk about how we're social animals, and how does that influence cooperation versus competition?
Yeah, well, I mean, the human brain evolved because of social needs. So the reason why the human brain is so big and why we have to be born in such small and fragile states, because the human brain has gotten so big, is to understand these social dynamics. The greatest form of torture that exists in the world is solitary confinement, right? The mind descends into madness without social relationships. Yet when we have social relationships, right, we also feel competitive feelings. And one of the biggest themes of our book is basically this, is that in every relationship we have, whether it's with our married spouses, whether it's with our friends, whether it's our colleagues, whether it's with our siblings, is characterized by constant tension between cooperation and competition. Taking new parents, for example, they cooperate to help raise this infant, but at the same time, at 3 a.m, they compete fiercely for sleep. Siblings compete fiercely for parental attention, but also cooperate. And twins, I mean, even twins, you see them kicking each other in the womb. And I'm a twin myself. And so my brother competed very successfully in the womb and was 50% larger than I was. So, you know, there's this constant tension going back and forth in every relationship. And it's fluctuating all the time based on the needs of the individuals and the resources and the environment.
I love that. I've never met someone who got beaten up earlier than I did. For me, it was elementary school.
Yeah.
I love you're getting kicked around in the womb. And so, you know, you also detail something with social animals, that how we use gossip. This is such an illustrative thing, that it's both a bonding tool and a tool for competition. We use it to hammer people too.
Yeah, absolutely. So gossip is one of those interesting forces that really sit at the intersection of cooperation and competition. When I gossip about someone, I'm basically competing against them, but the person I'm gossiping with, I'm cooperating with and forming this bond. And, you know, people always talk about one of the ways that some non-human primates bond with each other is through, you know, picking and grooming each other. And basically social gossip is almost our form of physical grooming. It's a way that we connect with people. And but at the same time, the targets of our gossip are forces of competition.
Yeah, that's so, so interesting. And you talk about your third of the ongoing tension between cooperation and competition is living in an unstable world. So we talked a little bit about being adaptive to the environment. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the world is constantly changing. The example I gave of the zebras, right, where, you know, they haven't just evolved to be one type of person. They've evolved to adapt to their environment, whether resource of water is scarce or not. We see this all the time with things change. Think about a young kid who suddenly has a new sibling, right? And so the world is constantly changing, people coming in and taking resources away. In fact, one of the ways that kids try to prevent these new siblings from even coming to being is through breastfeeding, because breastfeeding actually prevents ovulation or limits ovulation. And so we're constantly dealing with this fact that the environment's going to change. We can, you know, be in one situation and all of a sudden some piece of information comes in and changes the dynamic, takes a competitor and makes them more cooperative, or takes someone that we thought we were cooperating with. We get new information and suddenly we see them as a competitor. And so there's a constant fluctuation that goes on based on a variety of different resources and information as they exist.
And I was really interested in how you talked about how similarities intensify competition, that they kick our competitive instincts into high gear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of the things we talk a little bit about, is that it's really, really hard to not engage in spontaneous comparisons with people. And the people that we're most similar with and the people that we're most connected to are the ones we're most likely to compare ourselves to. So there's a famous study that looked at trying to understand weight gain over time, and they found that social networks were a big predictor, but the biggest predictor was the people that were most similar to you, so same-sex friends or spouses. It's part of the reason why husbands gain weight when their wives are pregnant. And we even see this with twins, right? There's a curious finding that oftentimes twins reared apart are more similar than twins reared together, because what do twins reared together do? Well, they constantly have to differentiate themselves. We think, oh, twins reared together are going to be more similar. They're both genetics and environment, but they also have comparisons, and those comparisons drive us to try to differentiate ourselves from each other. And so I'm a twin. You know, my brother was a better runner than I was. I ran pretty fast, but not as fast as him. And so I switched to a different sport. And so you can just sort of see how those types of comparisons really drive people and help determine the directions that they go in life.
You also explain how we understand value by comparison. And I particularly love the story of the monkeys trading stones with researchers for
yes.
food. Tell us about what happened.
Well, they do this whole thing where a monkey trades a little token or a stone and they get a food, and often they give them cucumbers, and the monkey loves the cucumber and will eat it all day long and be very happy trading stones for a piece of cucumber, unless they see the monkey next to them get a more attractive piece of food. They get a grape. And so it's what's amazing, if you see this video, the monkey gets a cucumber, eats it, is really happy, then notices the monkey next to him gives a stone and gets a grape. He gives a stone immediately thinking he's going to get a grape, but he gets another piece of cucumber. And this piece of cucumber that he just ate seconds ago, he now takes it and throws it back at the experimenter and starts shaking the cage. Basically, when he sees this other person get a grape, he goes apeshit.
That is so amazing. And another example that's like this, I love this. You'd think that winning a silver medal in the Olympics would make you feel fantastic. It turns out that the silver medal is the shit prize of the Olympics. So tell us why.
Yeah, again, it's about comparison. So when you win, one study looked at, and they looked at, what's the percentage of people that smile on the medal stand during the Olympics or during different ceremonies? They found that, you know, almost 100% of the gold medalists smile, about like 90% of the bronze medalists. But in one of the studies, they found 0% of the silver medalists smiled. Now, silver is better than bronze, except it's got a worse comparison, because the silver medalists compare upwards, like, I could have gotten the gold, whereas the bronze medalists compare downwards and think, I almost got nothing. I'm so lucky to be on this medal stand. And it's, you know, another curious finding that we mentioned in this book is that there's very clear data that if you graduate from college in a recession, that you will have worse lifetime earnings for the rest of your life. Sometimes I think it's like 7 to 11% less income. However, research has also found that when you graduate recession, you actually live a happier life, because you're so fortunate, you feel so lucky to have gotten any job when you graduated, whereas if you graduate in a boom time, you're like, I could have taken this other job, maybe that was the better job, and we're filled with these alternatives and regret. And this allows us instead to, you know, just to focus on how lucky we are.
Yeah, it's so interesting how relative value is so important. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab, The Science Between Us. My guest tonight is Dr. Adam Galinsky, and his new book, co-authored with Dr. Maurice Schweitzer, is Friend and Foe, When to Cooperate, When to Compete, and How to Succeed at Both. And now this is so interesting. You explained that comparisons can motivate us to run faster, play harder, even rocket to the moon, but they can also push us to engage in very risky actions or even unethical behavior. You give this example of faculty members cheating to make their articles look more downloaded. And you said it seems they're more likely to do this when their peers had high download counts.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we're constantly comparing to other people, and often the people that we compare to are the ones that we're closest to. And so, for example, if you're at a university and you're coming up for an important review in the near future, but some of your colleagues have lots of papers that lots of people are downloading, well, now you want to look good in the eyes of your school. You feel threatened by those comparisons, and then you engage in duplicitous means to increase your download rate. We also see this we see this experimentally. So I've done a bunch of experiments where we show that when people feel rivalrous, they're more likely to engage in ethical behavior. We see this. We analyzed tons of data from the Italian Soccer League. And when teams engage in matches with other teams from the same cities, they have more red cards and more yellow cards. And we even see this with companies. When Virgin came on the scene, British Airways was very threatened and did all these underhanded tactics, including calling their customers and telling them that their flights had been canceled and offering them seats on British Airways flights instead. So we can see comparisons and rivalry are, they can make us motivate us. They can make us miserable, like the silver medalist, and they can inspire us to engage in unethical behavior, too.
You have great advice on how to manage rivalry, and that's to err on the side of modesty. And also, something we don't really think of, you advise sharing negative information about yourself. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think, you know, people don't like feeling envious and jealous towards other people. And it's a negative feeling. And so you want to try to make people feel sometimes good about you. I'll give you a funny story from my own life and my own experience. I got these reviews once, teaching evaluations. I got very good evaluations. But one of the students wrote, "I like the professor, but not nearly as much as he liked himself."
Oh, no.
And so I realized, you know, I was trying to look good in the classroom by telling, you know, good stories about myself. But then what I decided to do was start telling stories about my failures and about how the time I didn't negotiate effectively or how I didn't give feedback well. And I learned from one of my colleagues how to give feedback better. And then I found that just that sense of humility, you know, took away maybe any envious feelings or jealousy, and allowed people sort of to connect more. And, you know, I've even noticed that, you know, even in talking about the book, talking about some of the things that didn't go as well with the book, seems to get people to feel more sympathetic than all the things that go well with it. So you can see that all the time.
Yeah, and I think this is especially important advice for women. I did a show with sex differences researcher, Dr. Joyce Benenson, and she explained, as Ann Campbell does, that women bond over shared vulnerabilities while men are much more comfortable with competition. So I think if you're a woman, it's especially important to do this, especially around other women, to make sure that they don't see you as Miss High and Mighty, to tell them, you know, you have a run in your hose or whatever. I don't know if people wear pantyhose anymore because I don't leave the house anymore. I'm writing a book. So, but just tell them about your vulnerabilities. You actually talk about this in relation to somebody being like, you know, in a big position, like a psychiatrist, that if you have some kind of big position, that it helps to be kind of a flub up at first to make people comfortable.
Well, I think there's two things to know about that. First of all, is I think it's really important that people respect you. So when you walk into a psychiatrist's office, psychologist's office, you already respect their credentials. And so one of the things that some psychologists that we've talked to and psychiatrists is that they drop some pens sort of to make themselves sort of seem sort of vulnerable. Maurice had a former student who was really well respected at work but wasn't well liked. And so what she did is she made herself a little more vulnerable by starting to purposely add some typos into her emails. So she didn't always appear to be perfect. And then she found that people actually treated her better. And there's a famous study that's the coffee spill study, where they showed that you had a person who was, you know, really respected and only had good things happen. A person that was really respected and then spilled some coffee. Someone who wasn't respected and spilled some coffee. And what they found is the person who was actually liked the most was the person who was respected and spilled the coffee. But it was only after that they were respected. If they spilled the coffee before they were respected, it didn't have the same positive impact. So you want to establish your respect and then make yourself a little bit humble is the best way to get the people to trust you the most.
That's so fascinating. I experienced this with Albert Ellis, who you know who he is. He's the late father of cognitive behavioral therapy. And he was this cute little man, and he had crumpled Kleenex in his pockets, this big jacket and everything. And you want to hug him when you see him. So even though he's big and famous, you immediately connect to his warmth because he seemed so approachable because he was so vulnerable in those ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, vulnerability, you know, having the right amount of vulnerability is a great way to connect with people and shared vulnerability. That's why, you know, a lot of times we do karaoke before negotiations in some countries. It's this idea of like, we're going to make ourselves mutually vulnerable. We're going to all sing badly and laugh about it. And then that's going to allow us to trust each other. And then we can negotiate more effectively the next day.
Wow. I love that. So let's talk about power for people who don't have it yet. I love this. You have this great trick in your book from your own research for a person to give themselves a psychological dose of power. So tell us about that.
Well, many years ago, I started studying power over almost 2 decades ago, and we wanted to really get into, you know, power, but we were worried about just making someone like a boss or employee in the lab or trying to give them power because there's lots of different reasons. And so we ended up trying this technique where we asked people to simply recall a time in which they had power and just to write that out. And we had this, I had this experience with one of my former students, Jillian Koo. She went to London Business School and she was feeling really nervous, and they gave her a time before her 90-minute lecture where she was going to be attacked and asked questions to just prepare. And she decided to write out one of these power primes, spent about 15 minutes writing it out, and it went it went so well. She was, you know, just in total command of the room. And then we did an experiment in France where we had people who were applying for business schools before their interviews, these mock interviews, and we had some of them recall time when they had power, some recall time when they lacked power, and some were in a baseline condition. And the people who had simply recall time when they had power were twice as likely to be admitted than the people with all the time when they lacked power. So you could really see this effect of just thinking about power and transforming people's psychological state.
Wow. I just want to repeat this because that's so important. So power prime is thinking of a time when you had power. Write that down if you can. That's really, really important because it really does help you go in from a better place, a more confident place, than if you're just going in there thinking, oh, this is hard. I have so much competition.
Yes.
So
yeah, it gives you that competitive leg up. Yep.
Okay, I want to talk. Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off. What did you say? What did you want to say?
No. Okay. I just said, yeah, it gives you a competitive leg up, the power prime.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so hierarchy, because this is something that we experience, especially people who are in the church or have been in the military. You say that hierarchy helps us solve the dilemma between cooperation and competition.
Well, so basically what hierarchy does is that by increasing patterns of deference, it allows for cooperation and coordination within a group, which allow groups to compete more effectively with other groups. And there's lots of data to suggest that when groups are able to coordinate their behavior, they're more effective. And hierarchy is one of the ways to do that. So one of the findings that we have in the book is something we call the too much talent effect. And the too much talent effect is groups that really have to coordinate their behavior, once they get too much talent, people don't want to defer to other people. They want to be the alpha and the big cheese. And therefore, they put themselves into a situation where they don't pass the ball as well. So in basketball, we showed that when teams get too much talent, they basically don't have as many assists, and that leads to lower performance. And what hierarchy does, it creates patterns of deference that allows people to be more effective. But there's a downside to hierarchy too, which is that it doesn't let low-power people express their opinions. And so what we need to do to solve this dilemma between cooperation and competition is get the coordination benefits of hierarchy, but without the downside of low-power people having their voices silenced.
Right. And you talk about this thing that to have a well-functioning hierarchy, you have psychological safety for the less powerful. And you give the example of Johns Hopkins Hospital, how they empowered nurses to intervene if doctors skip steps in sterilization. And so that's really important to have, you know, have the sort of the lower people empowered so they can give their opinions, because sometimes they have the solutions when other people don't.
Yeah, and I think I'll just give you sort of three very quick examples of this, because you mentioned that. It's like the key thing is, how do we create psychological safety? And hospitals are a great example of that, because nurses have so much less power than doctors. And so what they did at Johns Hopkins, they said, look, the nurses are in charge of the checklist. If a doctor skips them, you have the authority to insist that they engage in that behavior. And they reduced mainline infections and surgeries. Another example is, a lot of companies and organizations are learning that if we collect information privately from people, then we can actually be more effective in soliciting everyone's opinion. So there's apps, like there's an app called the Candor app, C-A-N-D-O-R, which allows you in a meeting then to have everyone express their opinions, but without having to voice it themselves. And therefore, they're less likely to feel limited in their expressions. And one of my favorite examples of is at The Shield, this TV show where the head producer noticed that the young women weren't expressing their opinions during pitch meetings. And he said, I'm going to be a good guy. I'm going to go tell them and encourage them to speak up. And they laughed in his face. And he's like, what? And he's like, well, watch what happens when we do speak up. And he noticed that they were constantly interrupted. So what he decided to do was he put in a no interruption rule. And this no interruption rule not only allowed the women to speak up more effectively, it allowed everyone to speak up more effectively, and it just made better pitch meetings. And so you can give the power some authority, you can collect information privately, you can put some rules into place, and then you can get the benefits of the silencing of low-power voices.
Yeah, I think that's really important. So in other words, to get the lower powered people in hierarchy to contribute, you have to have rules that tell the high powered people to shut up and listen to them. I think that's really, really important. I want to talk about trust next.
Yes.
So big part of cooperation is trust. And you say that research shows that people who inspire the most trust exhibit two distinct qualities, or two traits rather, warmth and competence. And you say that we inherently project either warmth or competence usually, but to build these strong relationships, we need to project both. How do we do that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is, you know, great work that's done by Susan Fiske and Amy Cuddy, and a lot of other people have explored this topic. But, you know, the people, when we respect someone but don't like them, right, we envy them. When we like someone but don't respect them, we pity them. But the only way to really get to that high level of positivity is when we respect and like someone. And there's lots of different ways. So that we give this story of a guy running for Congress who's down in the polls, and, you know, everyone's like, we respect the guy, we just don't like him, he's not very warm. So he tried to start smiling, but it became forced and kind of freaked people out. He looked like the Joker. But then he worked with a political consulting team, and they're like, they said, just talk to us. And they just they diagnosed, and they basically looked, when did he ever light up like a Christmas tree? Like, when did he just brighten up? And it was whenever he talked about his kids. So he said, okay, here's what we're going to do for you. Every time you do a political speech, you're going to talk about your kids, and they're going to get to see that warm person. And he came from down in the polls against a 20-year incumbent and won because he was able to tap into that likable side of himself because he was already respected. You know, we already talked about some of the ways we do that with the typos and the karaoke and other mechanisms, but we're looking for opportunities to be both respected and liked. We can use credentials, right? That's what the psychiatrist does. But then they add, you know, some warmth by, you know, telling a bad joke or spilling some pencils. And so we're constantly trying to find a balance between being both respected and liked. The problem is that people focus on too much on one and let go of the other.
God, I love that. And I want to ask you about being face to face, because you say that that is extremely important in building trust. And so my question is, does Skype work? You know, because you can't touch people, and you talk about touch being important.
Well, I think that, you know, the more immediacy there is in any type of interaction, the more connected that you're going to feel. So, for example, there's more immediacy in instant messaging and text than there is in email, but then there's more immediacy in FaceTime than there is in instant messaging, and then there's more immediacy in face-to-face contact than there is over FaceTime. And so you can see that, you know, each one of those is going to increase the opportunity for cooperation and rapport becomes more important over time. Now, sometimes we don't actually want to be face-to-face. And so one of the findings of my research is that face-to-face helps increase cooperation unless the people are feeling incredibly competitive to each other, and then coming face-to-face only incites and enrages and intensifies that negativity and that competitive feeling. And so our research shows that sometimes when people really don't like each other and really are hostile towards each other, you can actually get to better negotiated agreements if you actually separate them a little bit, have them, you know, interact over email rather than face-to-face, so their intensity can't be so pronounced.
I love these nuances you cover, and there are many little behavioral tricks in your book, but I think I want to wind up with one of my favorites. This is Allison Woodbrook's study of strangers asking to borrow people's cell phones. So tell us about that study.
So in this study, they went to the train station, 30th Street train station in Pennsylvania, on a day that it was pouring. And they you know, you went up to strangers and said, can I borrow your cell phone? Now, people don't want to give up their cell phone. Give it to strangers, someone could run away with it. We have so much private information on our cell phones. It's very vulnerable to give someone our cell phone. But before she asked for the cell phone, for some of the people, she said, hey, I'm really sorry about the rain today. Can I borrow your cell phone? And just by sort of apologizing for something that she wasn't even responsible for, but kind of making a connection with this person, allowed the increase of probability of people by a dramatic amount that they would give the cell phone. So there's another example where, you know, you're asking for something that can be seen as competitive, to take someone's cell phone, can make someone vulnerable, by framing it in a way that inspires a cooperative response by apologizing or expressing sympathy and empathy for, you know, the state of the weather, you increase the probability that people will cooperate with you rather than reject you.
And so you could do this with anything, like, I'm sorry that, you know, it looks like you had a hard time with your shoe, or sorry that you have to study so much if somebody's carrying a lot of books. It's just this sort of I'm sorry and I'm empathizing with you kind of connection.
Absolutely. It's this idea saying that, like, I understand where you're coming from. I appreciate the difficulty that you're facing right now. And people like it when people understand and respect those difficulties.
It's so amazing. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab, The Science Between Us. My guest tonight has been Dr. Adam Galinsky, and his new book, co-authored with Dr. Maury Schweitzer, is Friend and Foe, When to Cooperate, When to Compete, and How to Succeed at Both. Adam, thank you. This is just a wonderful show, really interesting stuff, and a great book.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. I'm so excited to be on your first live show of your